Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents It's Not a Rumor, a Rock and Roll Journey Through Life and Alzheimer's, by Frederick Moore, with Shannon Guyton. Read by Michael Butler Murray. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Here's my story, the best I can remember it. Prologue. The Rick and Renee Show. Renee's Story. I don't know why, but you stick with me like glue. I don't know why, but I like it. From True and Trusted Companion. Dr. Amos's office at Santa Monica Neurological Consultants, Los Angeles, 2015. If you had told me 20 years ago that Rick and I would be doing a gig together at a neurologist's office, a year after he was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease, I would have told you, that's mishigas. Put down your crack pipe and get real. But there we were. I'd been playing guitar on and off since I first met and fell in love with Rick when I was 13, and I'd gotten pretty good under his direction. But I hadn't performed in front of an audience since I was around 14. In 1971. Back then, Rick taught me how to play Norwegian Wood by the Beatles, and we performed at my friend Margie Finger's talent show in front of 40 people, which might as well have been 400, as nervous as I was. All of my sister Roseanne's artsy friends from Fairfax High School in Los Angeles were performing. This is no small thing. Fairfax High has been known to produce some epic musicians. We went to school with Slash from Guns N' Roses and the guys from Social Distortion, as well as Flea and Anthony Kiedis from Red Hot Chili Peppers. Roseanne's high school friends, Stuart and Ralph Gordetsky, had a band called the Penguins, and they kicked off the show by playing a strange combination of music on a recorder, flute, and bongos. Next, Paul Volk played the flute. Then Margie and Roseanne sang, and Artie Farkas recited a science fiction meets erotica poem he wrote. He was into Hermann Hesse novels. When it was our turn, I froze in fear. But Rick's strong presence calmed me, and we pulled it off. Rick played other songs on his own. He could play any song from any band after humming a few bars. Margie's mom, Julie, exclaimed with her mouth wide open while watching Rick, "Wow, who's the professional?" Doing a gig at the neurologist's office was my idea. I wanted Dr. Amos to see what Rick was like as a musician, instead of judging him only on the memory tests he takes at our monthly appointments. At these appointments, sitting in Dr. Amos's office, we always play with the skeleton and brain models, commenting on how weird the vertebrae look. When Dr. Amos comes in, he sits down across from us and opens Rick's file. He looks like a professor, with round glasses and sandy blondish hair graying at the temples. He's usually wearing a golf shirt, khaki pants, and brown shoes. "Okay, Rick, tell me what day it is today," Dr. Amos usually starts. He speaks quickly and with a smile. Tuesday?" Rick answers. "It's actually Thursday." "Well, I don't go to work, so there's not really a need for me to know that," Rick reasons. "I understand. What floor is my office on?" Dr. Amos says, continuing down his checklist. Well, Renee pushed the button, so I'm not sure. 3, maybe? Actually, 5. I'm in office 525E. Do you know what city we're in?" "Of course. Los Angeles." "Yes, indeed." Next, Dr. Amos asks Rick to subtract 8 from 13, spell world backward, and recreate a shape on a pad of paper. Rick is asked to remember 3 words, light, watch, and pen, and recall them a few minutes later. Then it's time to stand up and walk in a line, like a side-of-the-road sobriety test, to check his balance. Lastly, Dr. Amos looks in Rick's clear, oceanic blue eyes to see how they move side to side. Rick endures the tests quietly and politely, cracking a joke here and there. The day of our gig, I wasn't only nervous for myself, but also anxious about whether Rick would be having a good day. I really needed Dr. Amos to see Rick's Freddy side, Rick's performer alter ego. I needed him to see how music flows in Rick's bloodstream, how it resides permanently in his muscle memory, how joyful and engaging he is when he's singing with his guitar, how music emerges in Rick from his soul instead of his brain. Dr. Amos needed to meet Freddie so he could understand who Rick is at his core. He needed to see what's at stake to lose. Rick and I had been practicing for weeks. We had a set list of 3 songs rearranged for our acoustic guitar duet: Analusia, Midnight Motel, and True Blues, the songs I was most comfortable with. In the doctor's office's blandly decorated lobby, I set up a music stand that holds a lyric binder to help prompt Rick to remember what words come next. Rick's holding his Fender acoustic, and I've got my acoustic Taylor. I am jittery as hell. Doctors and nurses file in. They bring a chair for me to sit in. Rick prefers to stand. It's innate by now that when he's playing, he's moving. Dr. Amos and the rest of the staff take their phones out, pointing at us, ready to record. I feel a lump in my throat and wonder what kind of frog squeak is about to come out if I start to sing. "You ready, Boschke?" Rick asks me. "I have to pee like a banshee," I whisper in his ear. "Well, at least it's not diho," he jokes back, our word for diarrhea. We've been together so long we have our own language. He turned to the audience. "You see," he says, "I had this crappy hand-me-down, practically broken television where I used to watch the Beatles play. One day when I was 17, back in 1967, I watched them sing a song about a girl named Analusia. I thought, what a beautiful name. I should write a song about her, too." Now, you might be thinking, "Wait, I don't know a Beatles song about a girl named Analusia." Well, you're right. There isn't one. What I heard as Analusia was actually "I'm a Loser." But now there is a song about Analusia, and it goes like this. When he counts down, 1, 2, 3, 4, I know there is no going back. It is time to play. Rick and I were on fire, singing to the delighted and dancing faces of Dr. Amos's caring staff. On our last song, True Blues, we took it home. The song suits him. It's raucous. He only needed to glance at the lyrics on the music stand once. When we finished the set, our audience whooped and hollered. Dr. Amos pulled me aside and said, "I see what you mean about Rick. Your show was music to my ears. Get it?" A year prior, in 2014, we were in Dr. Amos's office getting the most shocking, worst news I'd ever heard in my life. I knew something was wrong when I booked the appointment, but I was too afraid to consider what. I'd been seeing Rick forget things he never would have before, like leaving burners flaming on the stove or forgetting where he'd parked his beloved Toyota Prius. I knew it was time to find out what was going on when he was supposed to deposit a bonus check I'd received at work, but accidentally left it at Stir Crazy, a coffee shop on Highland Avenue in Hollywood. Luckily, the guy who found it called me at work, and I got it back. But still, that never would have happened to my Mr. Control Freak before. Neurological testing wasn't easy on Rick. One particular test he underwent lasted 5 hours. Midway through the exam, a flushed and irate Rick bolted out the exam room door. I jumped up to follow him to see what had happened. "This is a fucking scam," he shouted in the hall. "What the hell? Am I some kind of guinea pig or something?" "Let's go get a snack," I said calmly. We walked to a nearby Whole Foods. Sitting on the benches outside, he was calmer, but still agitated. One of our songs, Elvis Costello's "Every Day I Write the Book," came on, softening his mood. We took a moment to sing to each other. "And I'm giving you a longing look," Rick sang. "Every day, every day, every day I write the book," I sang back until the song was over. Even though the song is about how we write our own stories, I was starting to feel very out of control of ours. "Renee, I don't understand what their questions have to do with anything." "What kinds of questions are they asking you?" I asked, as I dipped a pretzel chip into hummus. "It's so stupid. It makes no sense. Sock, yellow shirt, now what?" they ask, as if there's some logical answer. How can they learn anything from that? How does that help me? What did you answer?
I said, do you want me to just make some bullshit up?
We ate the rest of our food in silence as Rick calmed down. Well, let's go get the rest over with, he said finally, and we walked back to the doctor's office. He completed the test, as well as 13 others. He scored less than the first percentile, indicating significant impairment. I had wanted an answer to Rick's memory issues, but to hear the words major neurocognitive disorder indicative of Alzheimer's disease and have it applied to the love of your life, there's just nothing that could have prepared me. My body shook as my world shattered around me. Dr. Amos's mouth was moving, but I couldn't hear him. Somehow my lungs kept breathing and my heart kept beating, but I was spinning in a tornado like Dorothy. When he stopped talking, there was a terrifying quiet and a long pause, like the moment after Dorothy's house hits the ground with a thud, before she opens the door to a new world. Only the world outside my door wouldn't be in vivid technicolor. I was fading from technicolor to black and white.
Wait, what? Can you repeat that?
I asked. See this area on Rick's brain, the areas that hold short-term memory and the hippocampus? There isn't as much activity. The neurons aren't firing in those areas as they should be. We sat in stunned silence as we stared at the glob of dots and colors on the scan of Rick's brain. Information flew at me, but it wasn't sinking in. It was bouncing off my head. Dr. Amos continued, Rick has type 2 diabetes, as you know. About 50% of people with Alzheimer's also have type 2 diabetes. The current theory is that the brain is starved of glucose, and then it gets too much.
But we have his diabetes under control, I stammered, defensively. His numbers never increase, he doesn't eat sugar, he doesn't eat carbs, he gets a good night of sleep, he doesn't eat after 7 p.m., exercises.
I was shooting off solutions like a machine gun. This couldn't be happening. We followed all the rules. You're doing a great job. All of those things help. I'm going to consult with my colleague, Dr. Bredesen. He's the head of Alzheimer's research at UCLA. We went to medical school together.
Why is this happening to me? Why? Like a scratch on a record.
This is a question I have every time something bad happens. I think it might be because I'm Jewish and was raised knowing Jewish people have so often been punished. Is it because I'm so in love with a man who isn't Jewish and is much older than me that something had to destroy my happiness? That because I was allowed over 30 years of happiness with my best friend and love of my life, I am not allowed to live happily ever after? We left the office quiet, tearful, and scared. I couldn't go back to work afterward as I had planned. Since then, I have learned never to go back to work after our monthly appointments. I spent the next few months depressed, going through the motions of work and life in a daze. Alarm, dress, drive, work, drive, undress, bed, repeat. Even though Rick was very much alive and right in front of me to see and talk to, I felt an enormous loss. A loss of the version of Rick I had fallen in love with. A loss of the security I used to feel, of knowing what was to come in our future. A loss of my own identity in our relationship. I started hanging out with Rick while he was still married to Demi when I was just 13. My big sister Roseanne and Demi were besties at the time. When a family friend bought me a guitar for my 13th birthday, the Hohner guitar, which I still have, Rick taught me Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles. Roseanne, Demi, Rick, and I, and the whole Cats Band crew, all used to hang out in Rick and Demi's mega-cool Charlie Chaplin-era Willoughby Avenue apartment in the Fairfax district of Los Angeles. Even at just 13 years old, I was a huge groupie and went to all of their gigs. My sister would sneak me in the back door, or say I was Rick's little sister, since we looked so much alike. My parents were oblivious. My mother was frequently sick, and my father would take care of her. I'd sneak back in the house at 2 a.m., make a sandwich in the kitchen, and go to bed. These were some of the best times of my life, dancing all night to the most awesome music I'd ever heard, written by the cutest lead singer I'd ever seen. Over the next few years, Rick and I became best friends.
while Demi was busy trying to make it as an actress and attending Hollywood schmooze and booze parties, Rick and I hung out more and more. He was uncomfortable at all the industry events and with the wild lifestyle that was attached to them. We were both introverts and felt like outsiders in our families. My three sisters all married Jewish men, and I never pictured myself married at all. Rick and I clicked together like two puzzle pieces. We never ran out of conversation, and we shared the deepest parts of ourselves easily. Rick accepted me for who I was, and I did the same. Years later, after Demi had left, we started doing more date-like things together, like going to the elegant restaurant Yamashiro up in the Hollywood Hills. We'd hold hands and gaze at the koi gardens that overlook the city, or we'd go dancing in Hollywood at the palace. Rick hated going dancing, but he did it for me. Our first kiss was actually awkward, since I felt like I was kissing my best friend. But it didn't take long for that part of our relationship to click as well. I had to fight really hard for my relationship with Rick. My sisters, my friends, and my parents said, "He's too old for you." And, "He's a goy." Goy equals not Jewish. They were so adamant against my relationship that my sister set me up with a super religious Jewish guy. I felt obligated to go. I wore my coolest Madonna gear, a stretchy short beige Norma Kamali swing skirt, a crisp white button-down shirt, tights, short black boots, a black fake leather jacket with zippers, bright blue red lipstick, and a lace tie and my shoulder-length curly blonde hair. My date showed up wearing temple-appropriate black trousers, a white shirt, black dress shoes, and a yarmulke. We drove to a restaurant called Old World, a hip 50s retro British pub style on Sunset Boulevard. Across the table, I endured the most boring chat I ever had in my life. I knew everything about music and the scene, and he knew nothing. I could do nothing else but think of Rick all night. At my door, he tried to kiss me goodnight. I said, "No thanks, bye." One day when I was 17, my mother announced that I couldn't see Rick anymore. She was a tough-as-nails woman. Think George Costanza's mother on Seinfeld, or Marie Barone from Everybody Loves Raymond. Solid and strong. All she had to do was look at you and you'd start crying. We weren't allowed to say "shut up," or, as she would say in her Polish Brooklyn accent, "shut up." She'd kiss us so hard that our necks would hurt afterward. She used to hit my sisters and I, but she also thought we were the most beautiful and smartest of girls. "I want you to stop seeing him," my mother demanded. I had just dropped out of high school, convincing her I was afraid to go to school because of the high crime rate. I'm sure Mom worried because I was a good girl, until I met Rick. "No, I won't stop seeing him," I shouted in my best teen angst voice. She raised her large arm and hand to hit me, but this time I blocked it and forced her to sit down on the sofa. "That's it. I'm out of here." I stomped to my room and packed up some work and casual clothes and a few tchotchkes, my little cat playing guitar statue, my perfume and makeup. I drove my bright orange Volkswagen Super Beetle straight to the bank and withdrew all $250 that I'd saved. Then I took my fake ID, bought a bottle of Jack Daniels at the liquor store, and parked at the beach. I took a swig of the whiskey. Ugh, who drinks this stuff? And I pondered what to do next. At sunset, I got hungry, so I drove through Taco Bell, where a dollar in the 1980s could get you enough tacos to feed an army. Finally, I went to a payphone and called my sisters, who had their own apartment, and they said I could stay with them. Since I could share clothes with my sisters, I didn't have to go back home or speak to my parents for 6 months, when I finally had to get more of my stuff. With moving out early, going to clubs with my older sister's friends, and dropping out of high school, I had grown up really fast. Rick helped me recapture my childhood by taking drives to orange orchards or going to Knott's Berry Farm. We'd drive up to the snow for the day to throw snowballs. We'd go to Disneyland and pretend we were in New Orleans, where we sipped mint juleps watching jazz singer and bandleader Cab Calloway play Minnie the Moocher. We were kindred spirits. As perfect as things were between us, I didn't want to commit fully. I was afraid of losing my individuality and independence. I wasn't sure I wanted to become Rick and Renee and lose myself in the process. He had been my only boyfriend, and I wanted to create a space in my life that was my own. I also didn't want to strain my relationship with my parents while they were alive. They still didn't approve of us. Elsie, an older woman who lived in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment next door to my sister's, passed away, and I decided to take over her apartment and live on my own. I was done living with Roseanne. She had a lot of friends over, smoked a lot, and didn't clean up. My polar opposite. Rick and I kept separate apartments for almost 10 years, from 1985 to 1994. But when the Northridge earthquake made Rick's Willoughby place uninhabitable, he came to stay with me in my apartment permanently. Forced to move in together because of an earthquake, only in California. We eventually moved back into apartment 7 when Roseanne moved to Studio City, and our condo to this day is on the same street. One night in 1984, Rick and I watched Against All Odds and were inspired to go to Oahu, Hawaii for the first time. Oh, I can still smell that island fragrance. We rented a car and giddily drove to the first beach we could find. We said to each other, "Wow, isn't this the most beautiful beach you've ever seen?" Then we got back in the car and stopped 2 minutes later at another beach. "But this one, though, is really beautiful." And on and on and on, around the island. Our Hawaiian days started at the original pancake house at 6 a.m. We always grabbed a Honolulu Advertiser to do the crosswords over breakfast to see what would be on TV that night. Then we'd take a mid-morning swim at the Ala Moana Beach Park. At that beach, there's a sandbar far out into the water where surfers go. They walk along it and look like they're walking on water. I liked swimming there, because I'm afraid of the water, and there weren't very many waves. One day, bold and brave from the Hawaiian sun, we ventured farther into the ocean than we ever had before. We swam all the way to that sandbar and walked on it. Victory. But when I got back in the water to swim to shore, something large bumped into my leg. "Holy shit, Rick!" I screamed and flailed, as if I were in the movie Jaws. I'd never swam so fast in my entire life as I hauled ass back to the beach. I fell into my chair we bought that morning at Long's Drugs, and I scanned the water to see if I could spot the shark that had just tried to eat me. No shark, but a turtle popped his head up for air, and I realized that must have been what it was. After swimming, we'd go to a movie or the mall, and back to the beach in the afternoon for a second swim and dinner. At night, we'd see a Shakespeare play at the University of Hawaii, and then talk like Shakespeare the rest of the night. "Privy, take me back to the bedchamber," I'd say as Rick woke me up in the car arriving back at the hotel. Our nightcap was an episode of Jeopardy and 9 hours of sleep. There is no sleep like a Hawaiian sleep. Every Thursday night, I had dinner at my parents' house, and Rick would often come with me. One of the first times Rick came to dinner, my mom said to him, "Rick, did you know that in the Jewish religion, men have to be circumcised?" "Yes, I know, and I am circumcised," he said, matter-of-factly.
"No, you're not," she argued.
"Yes, really, I am. Do you want me to prove it?" My mom laughed so hard she couldn't stop and had to sit down. I think she liked him after that. She started offering him food and served his favorite dishes, kasha varnishkas, bowtie pasta with buckwheat and grilled onions, spaghetti with homemade sauce. My mom learned how to cook from the Italian lady she was friends with when she lived in Brooklyn. Matzo ball soup, challah, borscht or beet borscht with mashed potatoes. She started defending Rick to others as well. Once someone gave Rick a piece of chicken, and she yelled, "Hey, Schmendrick, don't you know Rick doesn't like to eat the chicken on the bone?" My mom, a loud Polish New York Jew, spoke half Yiddish and half English. Rick got to know my dad by helping him around the house. Dad used to fix everything with masking tape or nails, regardless of what the issue was. He didn't know about duct tape.
Refrigerator light burned out? Put some masking tape on it. Faucet leak? Drive a nail in it to cover the hole. Garden hose leaking? Masking tape. If a window screen wasn't staying in the window, he'd hammer 5 nails into the window frame and bend the nails over to hold the screen into place. Once, our front door deadbolt lock busted, and he hammered in 10 nails to fix it, which obviously didn't work. Rick stopped by with the new Schlage deadbolt lock, pulled out the nails, and installed it with precision. My dad was so impressed that Rick had good tools and knew how to fix everything, he asked him for help every time after that. Even though Rick won both my parents over, after 20 years of being together, they'd still ask, "Why can't you find a nice Jewish boy?" After my parents passed away, I felt a little freer to make things between Rick and I more official. In 2004, we bought our first place together, across the street where I grew up. Then things progressed even further in 2005, when a friend of Rick's got into a bad motorcycle accident. The hospital wouldn't let his girlfriend in to see him. His friend was comatose, and his mother kept him on life support for several years. "I think we should get married," Rick said, when he heard about his friend. "Why now?" I asked. "I don't want anyone but you making life decisions for me." Little did I know then how in charge of his life I would ultimately be. So on September 8th, 2005, my parents' anniversary, we went to Hawaii and got married. I wore a matching white linen shirt and pants. Rick wore a Hawaiian shirt and khaki shorts. "Will you promise to be best friends for the rest of your lives?" the Justice of the Peace asked. Rick had tears in his eyes when he said, "Yes." We had forgotten our rings, so we put leis around each other's necks. "With this lei I thee wed." After leaving the courthouse, we paused. "What do you want to do now?" one of us asked, and we started cracking up. What does one do after they marry the love of their life? Well, we went out to eat and went on with our lives, like no big deal. Rick always says we live life and love each other a ton every day, so we didn't need elaborate gifts or fancy parties. When we came home, my sisters threw us a reception with a Hawaiian theme. It was wonderful to finally have their support. After work, we hosted regular TV and movie pajama parties, when we'd watch Newhart or Saturday Night Live on our antenna TV, or movies like The Big Chill. The only people at these parties were us. We wore flannel pajamas. Mine were blue flannel with white puffy clouds, and Rick's were Ralph Lauren plaid. We gained a shit ton of weight, eating truckloads of peanut butter, vanilla, or strawberry Häagen-Dazs ice cream. We'd each get our own tub. Nachos, Doritos, tacos, Pioneer chicken, which we dipped in mashed potatoes, Domino's pizza, and Entenmann's chocolate cake. I'd eat a row of the cake, and he'd eat the next row. Repeat. We were fat and happy. Rick was a genius. He once put the entire tax code into his computer and developed his own program to do our taxes. He basically invented TurboTax. He took classes at various colleges for fun and easily aced them all. He was always reading an intellectual book and teaching me about everything from Shakespeare to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. His thirst for knowledge was unquenchable. We used to talk like the quick-witted Gilmore Girls, changing topics mid-sentence. He was a multitasking Superman. My family hated playing Trivial Pursuit with him, because he'd win every time. And he was accepted to be on Jeopardy. Rick was a teacher. He convinced me I was smart and showed me how to learn. I never would have gone to or gotten through college without him. He took night classes with me, studied with me, and explained everything in such a way that it helped me to learn the subjects. With his influence and my trusty Commodore 64 computer, I was a professor favorite. When my mom passed away, he went to my classes for me, while I sat Shiva. Rick was a human map. He could look at a map just a few times and remember it in vivid detail in his head. My family would ask him how to get around. He was Google Maps before it existed.
It was like he could see the Earth from above and visualize the street grid of each city.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?